Colonel Burini, Reel 11. We've talked about the mortar platoon and the first few days in the line. Was there any activity from the Chinese in those early days? Were they shelling you and so forth?
There was a shelling, yes. Not me personally, not the mortar position, but usually the shelling was on the forward position, so this is the reaction to any movement that they saw by the mortars or heavy guns. Not very heavy guns, the mortars usually.
You weren't called into any counter action at all?
No. Not at all. That was what I was trying to do. To range on the various positions and to crest up the section because having ranged, which took quite a long time, I then said, right, we'll try a bit of fire for effect, and the tech was all over the place. So, I had to tell the CO that it might have pot luck should anything happen, and I just have to take it from as it occurs and hope that these bombs are judged more accurate. I mean, they're not intensely accurate problems anyway. There's a lot of tolerance as the shredding bomb goes down the barrel. I think the Americans, they had their 4.2 mortars. They were much tighter. They took a bit of time to go down the barrel. These things happened in the barrel. So that when they came out, they were spinning and all sorts of things. But now, having said that, when we were in Germany, they were remarkably accurate. So I don't know, it might have been the atmosphere or the heights or mountains or whatever.
Was your platoon made up of National Servicemen and regulars?
The senior NCO sergeant, he was a regular, can't remember his name. And I think two of the junior corporals were regulars, but the rest were all National Servicemen.
Were they competent? Were they well trained at that point?
Yes, I don't know who trained them, because I took them over, as you know, before on the ship. Whoever had had them in Germany when I left, had done a good job on them. They were very competent, yes.
It was early October, around about that time. What was the weather like?
Wet. That's what I can remember mostly. The hoochies were leaking. At that stage, they were homemade hoochies. We just sort of dig the holes and erect something round us and put whatever waterproof we could on the top, which wasn't very efficient. And of course the rain took it through, and it wasn't very pleasant. It was quite heavy rain actually. It wasn't raining all the time, but it rained regularly and quite heavily.
How were supplies coming up to you? I'm talking in terms of food and so forth.
Well, we had at that stage, we always tried to get hot food. It wasn't too bad for the mortar because we were quite a way behind. And we had our own cooker and we cooked our own meals. And the rations were set up when we used to cook them, all of them. There was always a reserve also of 24-hour pack rations, which were mostly American, very rich in oil. They were very good, but I found them very rich.
What was in a pack? What might you get?
The pack itself was about 8 inches by 8 inches cube, and it would contain tea, milk, sugar, a little cooker, which was heated by wood alcohol, which was part of the inside as well. There's a combat tin opener, which is a little thing which we used to go around the can. And then inside would be chocolate, usually the black chocolate. Sometimes there would be little raisins and nuts, but the tins of stuff for things like baked beans with chipolatas in, spaghetti. Tins of chipolatas as well, soup, tins of soup. At that stage, they were just ordinary tins which you opened and tipped into the mess tin and heated up. Later on, we got the self-heating thing, which had had to remember to do was to open it up as it exploded. I had done explode on it. But that was in the main what was in it. But they were very good packs, very good. The big problem was to make sure that we used to keep them in reserve. You had to check them regularly because they tend to disappear. Either the soldier took them or the Korean reporters that we had, probably the men in the main, I should say, or the soldiers would take them to give to them. But very often you have to just go there, find where they are, and then we'd back and be mixing it, we'd have to indent for some more. I tried to keep them as secure as possible. I put them in the command of the crew sergeant, you know, so it was as possible to see if they didn't get picked. And that was it, yes.
And each platoon presumably indented for its own supply for that number of men. Was that the way it went?
In the S company, yes, of course, we were isolated. But in the companies, we used to come as a company, and that would be distributed by the colour sergeant that we got from the line.
You mentioned the Korean porters. What were they doing? Presumably carrying everything up with them.
Something, yes, it is something, and they were absolutely invaluable, especially on the thing like 355, where the hills, like that. And they did all the heavy work. They used to hump the ammunition, the rations, the fuels for the vehicles, everything. If anything had to go away, they would pump that down to a certain point that would be collected. Yes, they were very, very useful indeed. A lot of them couldn't speak English, but they could make their feelings obvious. They picked up the old army words, you know, effing. But they couldn't say effing, they used to say effing. And it was good or bad, it would be 1 to 10. So 1 would be good. If it was excellent, it would be effing 1. If it was extra bad, it would be effing 10. But they attached themselves very well to the people that they were with. And we the soldiers used to like, you know, try to keep talk with them and that sort of thing. And they got on very well, I think the National Salesman was probably a more tolerant individual than the regular, which would have been with people like that. You know.
The onset of autumn and winter, had you been given any warm clothing at this point?
We had the combat kit. I think we tried it. We gave it a test there. It was the green combat jacket with green trousers, and we had cold weather boots with an insole and a thick stockings. And those cold weather boots were absolutely marvellous. So you could plunge as long as you didn't go over the top of the well. You could plunge in water keep your feet dry. They were excellent. And we had putties, of course, seen the bottom of the trousers, yes. Later on, when the winter really came in, or just before the winter started, really, I think it was the next time we were in the line, we got the inner parka, which was a huge, thick thing with a hood over it, with a wire that you could adjust to keep your vision and that sort of thing. And that was just the inner parka. Presumably, there was an outer parka as well, but we never actually got that. It wasn't really necessary. Of course, we also got long johns and winter underwear. And the equipment couldn't have been better.
Was it American or British or what?
British.
Sleeping, were the blankets you slept in or
sleeping bags?
Sleeping bags.
I think I told you before, in the Hoochie you would have some way to sleep. Like most of it was homemade stuff. And then you'd have one of these little wire camp beds and get it off the floor. You'd get some old ammunition boxes, put some soil or rock in, and put the legs on the boxes and wire them down with a cable so to stabilize it so that you could actually sit on the bed without the whole thing topping over. You had a ground sheet underneath. Of course, that kept the draft off from underneath, and then you just slept with the sleeping bag, in the sleeping bag. And of course, later on we developed the heating appliances, which Keith Robinson's thing was highly dangerous as well, with petrol or diesel, which is the most efficient and the most glamorous is a shell case through which holes have been drilled at the bottom, and you fed the I think it's absolutely white hot and everything around about was going, you know, really nice. But we did have one or two accidents and those fires caused by them. They were lethal, really, especially when it was with the petrol, because you know, could have gone back up the tube, and the tubes that we used had a homemade sort of tap on them, you know, which was a rubber, piece of rubber leading down from the container, and you'd have a sort of screw tap. Part of, I can't remember where it came from, but they were all over the place, and he just either screwed it up or unscrewed it as he wanted the flow to increase or decrease. Any maps that were needed for the over the front, he was kept in the command hoochie. There was another hoochie which was for that too. Certainly in the company we had a command hoochie. I was coming from the land to LC. I had all the maps and the telephone communications and that sort of thing.
Did you have any trouble with nature in the sense of rats or whatever running around, you know, lice, this kind of thing?
Yes, rats. I hate the rats. Yes, there were rats all the time. And mice as well. But I can't remember any. I never suffered it, so I can recall from lice or anything like that. We used to have a homemade sort of shower place down at the town headquarters where people could go every now and again. And of course, there was the mobile bath units which would come around. The Brit ones were the worst of the lot. The best ones were the Canadians or the Americans. Canadians, particularly, because when you went into a Canadian bath, mobile bath, you took all your clothes off, handed them in, and you got a new, completely new set of clothes. And so a lot of people actually finished up wearing Canadian uniforms. You know. But nobody was able to better our external combat stuff, the parka and the inner jacket and the trousers.
Was the bath unit a permanent part of the area? It was there all the time for you?
Yes. By the time we got there, I think we were completely static. And they were part of A echelon or B echelon.
The health of the battalion, how did that go?
I'm not really confident to be able to. Certainly, in my platoon, there was nothing special. And I didn't really hear of any horrors as far as the battalion was concerned. Certainly, when I went into the company. Surprising how little it was. Amazing.
Yes, I was going.
There wasn't many malingering either, I can recall. You know, there were all sorts of things that people, soldiers, could have made as an excuse for being back at Air Force. But there were very, very few that did it.
Yes, I was going to ask you how the particularly the National Service element settled into the routine and so on.
The amazing thing about it, they were excellent. Peter Jeffries, the CEO, he wrote a summary of his comments, and he said that they were absolutely first class. There was an exception, of course, but and presumably some of the exceptions were publicised. I found out one of those just recently, but as far as the opening appears, generally speaking, I think it's excellent, it really was. And that includes the regulars, of course. You know. And the officers were very good, they did what they had to do, and they were enthusiastic about it. Mm-hmm.
The exceptions, when you say exceptions, were those people who just moaned more than anyone else, or did they try to get away? They tried to get out of the place.
Everybody moaned about everything, you know, the weather and the food and but in fact, the weather wasn't all that pleasant, and the conditions that one had to live in the line wasn't all that different. the actual what was going on was accepted as part of life. And I mean, it's sort of it's something you've got to do in the army at the moment. Nothing's perfect. And you sat in chat and have a moment session, isn't it? Oh yes, people moan. But the general moan was largely about the weather.
No one running off, leaving the unit?
No, certainly not in my experience, never. Not even when, you know, I was out with the sharp end. Did anybody let me down or run off or anything like that? And that's the only one I've heard of. Was the one that Peter Delavigne mentioned about the CEO of Google not to refusing to go on patrol. But other than that, the other day I found out somebody shot himself in the foot when he was there on standard patrol. But those are the only two occurred instances of which I've heard. They were only second hand. I personally never experienced any kind of this whatsoever.
You were part of a Commonwealth Brigade, is that correct? Mm-hmm. And was that a part of a Commonwealth Division?
Yes. I think General Duke Cassells was the commander initially. And I can't remember who took over for the LK, or who took over for Mar West, I think. MAR West. Yes.
Did you see many visitors from the hierarchy?
Oh, yes, we kept them all the time. We had a visit, I think it was either this first break, or the second one, where from Natron, Terence Airy came over. He was at that time in the Terence Regiment. He came over from Hong Kong, where he was commanding. He had visitors as we had visitors from and parades from people like New Zealand, the war with the Swiss and the doctors. We have visitors from brigadiers, divisional commanders, army commanders. Oh yes, they were very nice in evidence. Quite a number of them came into the line to see that they were getting out as well.
Did Peter Jeffries get around the unit often?
Oh yes. Very good soldier. Very good soldier. The morale was the highest possible. Certainly as far as I was concerned, of course we were being well led. I mean the people that he was commanding, and including himself, were very, very, very experienced soldiers. You know, I mean, they all of them have been back to through the whole of the war, just about. Some of the seconds in the command have been the same, they've been through part of the war. And from captains upwards, you know, they were experienced people. I was probably the least experienced as far as being an activist. And so, but I'd been in the army since 1944, but anyway, you know, this was 52, that's 8 years. So, captains and above were definitely very, very experienced indeed. And Peter led by example. And he was just a wiry man, you know, a thin, wiry man. He just spied up, he was just like nobody. He usually showed up just when he didn't want it. Something was going wrong. And he was a spectacular area, which I think was partly responsible for the high morale of the battalion. If something was wrong, he told you so, and he got a Viking, and that was it. And it was, until the next time, that was it, it was forgotten. But you remember it, and you to make sure that particular mistake was not repeated. What felt the need to please the CEO.
And yet, although they were very experienced, this was a static war, which many of them hadn't had experience of, except probably the Burma people. You know, dug in positions, trenches, and so forth.
I mean, even the Burma people, they wasn't sort of just temporary thing in any case. It was a defensive. I mean, all soldiers had experience of defence. This was just a prolonged defence, which merely meant that they were able to fortify and strengthen the positions that we were in. And that, of course, came later. Once we got used to being in the line, we started to tidy it up. And I'm convinced that the powers that be used to put us in the part of the line with medium tidying up so that we, you know, that our little mining fibers would disappear like muffled and at the same time beautify the position. The Aussies used to call it tense beautification. couldn't believe it.
But the Durham's always had a high standard of trench discipline, didn't they, wherever they were?
But this is something that, again, this year, which is the London, the company commanders made sure that the officers did. Morale was paramount, it had to be, because it was such a static thing. The fact that one was going out on patrol pack the other night, when you were in the line, it's another sort of, it's a wearing thing. Even if you don't have a contract, you were sort of on edge for all the time you were out. Just if you had a contact, it was a release, really, a relief to have a contact, because at least you could, you know, well, this is it, you know, if it's sort of talking about it, all that.
After the early session, the first session you're in the line, you went into reserve. Where was this position relating to the rest?
Well, the Kansas line, I think. I think it was called the Kansas line. Which we were digging and maintaining. It was a fallback line from where we were to this place. I think it was about 7 or 8 miles behind the line. And we went and just dug on there, did our training and that sort of thing. It was somewhere around about Gloucester Valley, actually. It was the other side of the engine.
And you say you were digging there. Similar defences to the ones that you were in?
Yes. Putting out a couple of positions. We were camping actually as well. We were living in camp, but having camped, but we were digging in these positions whenever was possible. And in the meantime, we were also training. And that particular session, there was a lot of patrolling, practice patrolling, which is what obviously we were going to have to do. A lot of it went on in the first 10 days.
Did you feel that patrolling was a necessity in the line? It's a risky process.
Yes, it was necessary that you should keep the enemy, you should keep the form without the enemy. And the only way to do that was to go out on patrol and find out what you're doing. And also, the threefold purpose, observation of the enemy, keeping the enemy at bay and protection of your own positions, you know, knowing what the enemy is doing and reacting to it. And the patrols are most valuable. It's absolutely essential. I can't imagine a battalion in the position at any time for that matter. But if you don't patrol, you've got to patrol. Even though there's an active mobile war, you need to know what's going on, and the only way to find out is to go look. And this is what we had to do all the time. There were always patrols out every night, usually from the reserve company, but sometimes all the standing patrols, of course, were all from the forward company.
What was their particular responsibility?
That was to react to anything that was pointing close.
Like an early warning, in effect.
They would usually be anything from about 100 to about 300 or 400 yards away. That was obviously not good to put the troops on earth, because if they have to come in, they have to come in. And the longer they took, the worse they get. But generally speaking, and they were in strategic points, places, so that the enemy would have to come past them. That was just one sort of patrol. And there was the fighting patrol, the wrecking patrol, and the ambush patrol.
And what would be the role of the fighting patrol?
The fighting patrol was to go out and find something to fight with. So in other words, you just went out and made as much noise as you possibly could. That was usually about 15 strong, plus an officer, divided into three sections of five men. NCO in charge, and he would just probably use armed with automatic grenades and lot of that. We usually had these armored vests, and carried spare grenades, there would be a wild software that usually was a weapon, and you'd just wander around seeing if the vehicle you'd have a go at. I did a lot of them, and I never once that I have a committee, that I have a contact.
We'll come to that, Colonel. Talking in general about patrolling at this point, then we'll come to that as the story unfolds. The actual movement, you say 15 men, and what was the process of moving? Was there some kind of shape in the movement?
Yes,
the movement?
Yes, you would take up a formation, depending on the ground that you are. If you're on a ridge, it would obviously be I used to like to try and put a couple of scouts out in front who would be carrying grenades, ready to the pin out, ready to throw if anything happens straight away. And then if you got up on the flat ground down the valley, then you take up those in a different position, pre-arranged and pre-organised. Sort of three groups, one there, one in the reserve sort of thing. The commander would be either with one of them or in between the fires, and the three groups. When we were on Yeongdong, it was always possible to do that because there was miles of flat. Danger was that they might shell
again, to go on with in general terms on patrols, fighting patrols, we've done standard, static patrols, fighting patrols. What were the next two? Ambush patrol.
And similar for fighting, except they went with a specific purpose of attempting to ambush the enemy from an observed route, somewhere which thought that the enemy would like to come along and spring it. I did about a dozen of those, and I never had a contact again. And that would be just two people. They might go out with a firm base, or they could just go out and the idea was a specific, you're told to do something, don't find out what's happening over there. You would either go victim or secrecy, of course, and that one, not to be caught by the enemy. So you would go, observe, stay whatever length of time is necessary, and then come back in again.
And you say that was the two men, presumably one being NCO.
But it would be the commander and another. I used to go with a man called Clinton Moody. He was in one for two. And whenever I had to go out and patrol, I would just like to take him. He became a sort of mascot. And I don't know what he felt, but he used to come anyway.
So the men in the unit would classify as good patrollers?
Well, experienced, yes. The more they did, the more experienced they became, and the better they became at it, yes. Yes, there were football. At that time it was football, basketball. Later on, when the weather got better, we had cricket and athletics. But it was mainly football. And NCO entertainment.